You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 26th of April 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, broadcasting live from Studio One here in London. I'm Emma Nelson. Coming up in the next hour, after 4 years of hearings, the former Liberian President Charles Taylor becomes the first African head of state to be found guilty by an international court. We assess the trial. And we have a London mayoral special. We talk to the biographers of both Ken Livingstone and Boris Johnson as the two candidates face a rematch in the race for the capital's top job. All that plus a chat with Monocle's Santiago Tarditi and a song or two. That's right here on Midori House, here on Monocle 24. So lots to pack into the next 60 minutes or so. Before all that, let's get the latest news headlines from around the world with James Luckhurst.
Monocle 24 News. A United Nations-backed court has convicted former Liberian President Charles Taylor of war crimes. It's the first time an African head of state has been found guilty by an international tribunal. Taylor was charged with 11 counts of murder, rape, conscripting child soldiers, and sexual slavery during wars in Liberia and Sierra Leone, during which more than 50,000 people were killed. Hawa Momma is a spokesperson for the Liberian-based anti-corruption organization Transparency International. She gave her reaction to the conviction.
I feel good. I feel good because Taylor has been brought to justice. He has paid for what he has done to humanity. And for the women back in Sierra Leone, most women were humiliated. Their rights were violated. They were abused, raped, you know. Back home, when they hear this verdict, they'll be very happy.
Taylor has denied the charges, insisting he was trying to bring peace to the region and arguing that his trial was a politically motivated conspiracy by Western nations. Syria has blamed what it calls terrorist bomb makers for an explosion that ripped through a building and killed 16 people in the city of Hama. The Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, a British-based anti-Assad organisation tracking the 13-month-old conflict, gave the same death toll, but said the cause of the blast was not clear. In other developments, a United Nations mission has found that Syria's infrastructure has been significantly damaged in more than a year of conflict. Water and electricity supplies have been disrupted and many families cannot meet their basic daily needs. The United Nations is reported to be preparing a major aid operation known as its Syria Response Plan, which forms the basis of a $180 million appeal presented to donor countries last Friday at talks in Geneva. Protesters in Bahrain have attacked a police station with petrol bombs. Riot police responded with tear gas and stun grenades after a funeral march for a man who was killed in clashes during the Formula One race last week. France and Germany are looking to gather support among other European countries for new rules which will make it easier to suspend passport-free travel in Europe. The move comes as part of a bid to limit illegal migration. At a meeting of EU interior ministers in Luxembourg, French and German officials argued that national governments needed more power over border rules to ensure security in Europe when upheaval in the Middle East has increased migration in the region. However, EU Commissioner for Home Affairs Cecilia Malmström said any decision regarding borders within the Schengen area would need to be taken jointly in agreement with all Schengen area countries.
We think that Schengen is a project we have to safeguard, we have to strengthen it, but we have to make sure that it is something that where decisions are taken jointly on a European base. And this is the proposals of the Commission. They haven't changed.
The number of jobless people in France rose for the 11th successive month in March to hit the highest level since September 1999. Commentators say the announcement will add a new dent in President Nicolas Sarkozy's economic record as he battles to get re-elected next month. The Labour Ministry data shows the number of registered job seekers in mainland France has risen by 16,600 in March to 2.88 million. That's up 0.6% on the month and 7.2% on the year. At least six people have been killed in explosions at the offices of a leading Nigerian newspaper. Three people were killed in a blast in Abuja, with another three killed at the paper's offices in the northern city of Kaduna. Witnesses say at least one was a suicide bombing. Those are the main stories here at Monocle 24.
Thank you very much indeed, James. It's 5 minutes past the hour. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24.
Londonból, ez a Monocle 24.
Aus London, das ist Monocle 24.
De Londres, ez a Monocle 24.
De Londres, este es Monocle 24.
London から, Monocle 24 です.
De Londres, essa é a Monocle 24.
Londonist, sino Monocle 24.
Από το Λονδίνο, αυτό είναι το Monocle 24.
Λοντόστα, τέμα on Monocle 24.
Λόντζαδαν, βουρσε Monocle 24.
Λόντον καρά, Monocle 24.
The civil war in Sierra Leone lasted more than 10 years. It spanned the entire 1990s and early 2000, and it took the lives of more than 50,000 people and brought the country to its knees. Well, today, at a special court in The Hague, the former president of Liberia, Charles Taylor, was found guilty of aiding and abetting war crimes in Sierra Leone. Charles Taylor is the ex-president of Liberia, which is directly to the south of Sierra Leone. He committed Liberian troops and funds to the revolutionary United Front rebels in Sierra Leone in return for so-called blood diamonds. To assess the impact of today's verdict and the trial itself, I'm joined by the journalist Kate Thomas, and I'm also pleased to say Monocle's foreign editor Steve Bloomfield is in the studio with me. A welcome to you both. Kate, may I start today with you to ask you very briefly to sum up, if you can, the 4 years hearings that happened at The Hague. What was briefly it all about?
Well, of course, this trial began five years ago now. So it's been a long time in the coming. And I think the most important thing about it was that it had to be seen as fair, and that involved a lot of testimony. So during those 5 years, they called more than 100 witnesses to the court, including, of course, the supermodel Naomi Campbell. They assessed more than 500 exhibits, possibly even more than that. And it was all looking at Taylor's involvement in the Sierra Leonean war from his base in Liberia.
Steve, the important thing with this was that he was convicted, but three quarters of the charges against him, which basically involved the architecture of the atrocities committed in Sierra Leone, he was acquitted of those, wasn't he?
Yes, he has been acquitted of some. I think it would be interesting to see what happens next. There's the very real possibility we're going to get two separate appeals, one by the defence and one by the prosecution. I think that the key one that the prosecution is very keen to see happen is this idea that he was responsible for a joint criminal enterprise, that he didn't just know what was going on but in Sierra Leone, but that he was somehow coordinating it. But I think, I mean, it's interesting to look at the reaction in both countries today. In Sierra Leone, where these crimes were committed, it's a very somber atmosphere there, and people are very happy that this has happened. In Liberia itself, a lot of people still support Charles Taylor. He remains relatively popular, certainly amongst certain groups. So it'd be interesting to see what happens in both of those countries sort of within the coming weeks and months.
Do you think that Sierra Leoneans have now got some feeling of retribution, that they mean that they will be able to move on from this episode?
To a certain extent, yes. I mean, I think, you know, Sierra Leone has moved on an awful lot over the past decade. It's had some free and fair elections back in, I think it was 2007. There's a president that is seen in some respects as being not too bad, which for a country that's been through what it has is certainly a good thing. There are people that are keen to crack down on corruption there. There are efforts to improve the situation in terms of poverty. So it's certainly made a lot of progress. And I think that the fact that Charles Taylor has now been found guilty on some crimes at least will sort of help to bring a certain amount of closure.
Kate, just briefly explain to us what kind of atrocities were being committed in Sierra Leone.
Now, these were atrocities committed by the Revolutionary United Front rebels, largely. Their calling card was a horrible campaign, which they dubbed, it was a kind of war game called Short Sleeves or Long Sleeves, where they amputated limbs either at the elbow or the wrist, depending on the answer. Some of the crimes were even more horrific. They would bet on the gender of unborn babies and then open the bellies of pregnant women to decide on the winner. And and a whole host of other atrocities. So these were pretty nasty crimes, which the court has found, I mean, Taylor did not actively participate in, but he did.
The trial was originally supposed to take place in Sierra Leone, wasn't it, Kate?
It was, and I mean, the special court for Sierra Leone was something that grew from, it came from a request from the former Sierra Leonean president, who was able to get the court up and running in an agreement with the UN. So it was very much a case that came from Sierra Leone and was intended originally to be held on Sierra Leonean soil. The special court has prosecuted 12 individuals, I believe, and most of the others have been held in Freetown. Taylor's case was moved to The Hague amid supposedly regional security concerns.
Steve, talk to us a little bit more about this because you actually went to the special court in Sierra Leone. Tell us about what it was like there.
I did indeed. As Kate says, you know, it was this was a court that was set up in Freetown itself, the capital of Sierra Leone. The idea being that justice didn't have to just be done, but had to be seen to be done by the Sierra Leonean people. And it was very important that you had this, while it was an international tribunal set up with Sierra Leonean support and backing, that it should be in the country where these atrocities took place. However, because of the special circumstances of Charles Taylor and the fact that he still had supporters both in Sierra Leone and obviously more importantly in Liberia as well, it was felt that security wouldn't perhaps be best. However, to hold it there, however, he was held in Freetown for a few months. And what was quite interesting when I went there was they had this problem when they set up the jail. They set up a special jail to go next to the court because they had, I think at that time, 9 different people from 2 different sides in the Civil War, and they needed to find some prison wardens, some international prison wardens, who were experienced in keeping apart two warring factions in the same jail. And around this time that they were building this jail, the Mays prison in Northern Ireland, which had held IRA prisoners, Ulster Unionist prisoners, was being closed down. So they asked some of the prison wardens from Northern Ireland's Mays prison to come to Freetown to run this jail, and 4 of them did, and you know, and looked after these people, including Charles Taylor. And they talked about how, you know, Charles Taylor would be there reading his Bible in the morning and then go out and hit a tennis ball against the wall on his own, and you know, how they sort of managed to make sure that everyone sort of rubbed along okay.
The trial did come about in a very roundabout way, though, because Charles Taylor was originally granted asylum in Nigeria, is that right?
He was, and look, there's one sort of difficult aspect to this, which I'm going to expand on a bit tomorrow in a monologue on The Globalist, which is this issue of what this means for international justice, because in some respects, you know, this looks very good. A former head of state has been put on trial, has been found guilty of war crimes. This is the first time in a very long time something like this has happened. However, it's been done, the way he was put on trial in the first place was a little bit sneaky, in that a deal had been done to get Taylor out of Liberia in the first place back in 2003. Under the terms of that deal, he was going to go into exile in Nigeria and would be safe and wouldn't be charged. That deal changed. He was arrested. He was put on trial. He's now been found guilty. Now, that works once. You can pull that trick once. You can't do it again. So we've seen this in the case in Northern Uganda with Joseph Kony, when there's been suggestions he might agree a peace deal, where he's been worried that if he signs, it doesn't really matter what they say about him getting, being in exile, because they'll get him eventually. We saw it with Colonel Gaddafi as well. When the ICC were after him, and it was suggested that he wouldn't want to hand over, to give himself up under any terms of a deal. And we've seen it also in Sudan, where Omar al-Bashir has been indicted for war crimes, but knows that his best chance of staying out of jail isn't to strike a deal, but it's to remain as president of Sudan.
Kate, just let's develop that point a little bit. Taylor was convicted of aiding and abetting by supplying funds. Clearly, this was a president helping a neighbouring warlord, something which possibly Africa is no stranger to. We see it happen in Rwanda and Zimbabwe. Speaking from your, I believe you're in Africa, in Senegal at the moment, what's been the reaction on the continent to the idea that Taylor's verdict might be setting a very important judicial precedent?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you have a former head of state who goes down for aiding and abetting war crimes in a country he's actually never set foot in, and you have to wonder how many other countries or former leaders that could be applied to. And I think it's also important to consider the context as well. You know, there are people in West Africa, many ordinary people, who will say that that people like Taylor, they were not aware of these international tribunals when the events happened, that they have been basically prosecuted by the West in a tribunal that that has seemed to be something that's appeasing the international community much more than the people on the ground. Now, this is a slightly different case in that this has been very much about Sierra Leone, but when you look at how Liberians are feeling today, they feel very overlooked, almost a little bit invisible, that their president has been convicted of war crimes in another country and that perhaps they've been forgotten about. So I think that's an important thing to consider as well. I mean, in Liberia, they had a truth and reconciliation process, a commission that found results and that made a series of recommendations that have never been implemented. So they're feeling a little bit overlooked today, I think.
So, Steve, what are your thoughts on this? Because we've heard from Geoffrey Robertson QC today. He was the first president of the Special Court in Sierra Leone that you visited. And he drew direct parallels between Taylor and Sierra Leone and Putin and Assad. And that is obviously taking this whole idea of the responsibility of a national leader for aiding and abetting someone else's war to a whole new level. I mean, how far can you see this possibly going? And to what level of world leader could ultimately be found responsible?
I think it's a bit too early to tell yet, but it does set a very interesting precedent. And I think the threat of some sort of international criminal action can be very effective. When you look back at what happened in Rwanda and how certain people in the State Department in the US were trying to do, that really knew what was going on in Rwanda, were trying to do what they could to try and prevent it. And even things that they said afterwards, like ringing people up in Rwanda, ringing up relevant ministers and defence people and saying, we know what you're doing and we will get you eventually. They thought that that would make a difference. Now, for various reasons, they weren't even able to do that. And we can talk about that some other time. But that threat, that sort of, look, we know what you're doing and we now have these instruments in place to get you eventually, could be quite powerful. As I said before, I think there are issues over what this means for peace deals, because, you know, getting people to agree to these deals when it may put them open to prosecution down the road is going to be far trickier.
And very briefly, what kind of role do you think that the International Criminal Court or the geographical location of The Hague will have in determining the future of judicial operations like this?
The special court that was in The Hague wasn't the ICC, it was the Special Court for Sierra Leone, which was slightly separate, but it's still seen as kind of the same thing. And I think the ICC does have a problem that there's a perception that it's only gone after after Africans. Now, there's very good reasons for that. In every case, it's been because either the country itself has referred that case to the ICC or because the UN Security Council has referred the case to the ICC. So there are reasons why that's happened. But yeah, as Kate said, there is across Africa this perception that, you know, you guys are just coming after us. That's it.
Steve Bloomfield, our foreign editor, and the journalist Kate Thomas joining us on the line from Senegal. Thank you very much indeed for joining us. The time is 19 minutes past the hour. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. We'll be back right back.
The Urbanist is the show about the cities we live in. From mayors to street sweepers, from the CBD to the suburbs, this is the show that takes you to the heart of your metropolis. Join me, Andrew Tuck, as we speak to the planners, thinkers and politicians changing the urban world. In this episode, we focus on branding cities. We hear from experts Simon Anholt and Jeremy Hildreth, head to Bilbao to find out how the Guggenheim stamp of approval can transform a city, and we hear from those looking to rethink Jerusalem's conflict-cluttered international image.
I would like to see Jerusalem as the space where you can have differences and discussion within a democratic setting.
That's The Urbanist, premiering every Thursday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Emma Nelson. In a moment, we'll be chatting to one of our editors about what's going on the pages of this latest edition of Monocle magazine. Before that, taking us there, a little music. This is Adele and Hometown Glory. And that was Adele and Hometown Glory on Monocle 24, chosen because in the next half hour of Midori House, we'll be having a London mayor election special. Stay tuned for that then. Join us back in a moment. We'll be talking to Santiago Tarditi. And here he is in the studio. A warm welcome, Santiago.
Hi, Emma, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you, but I'm holding a rather meaty copy of Monocle. So, edition 53, the one with the ideal Japanese family on the front cover with a pretty dog. You, however, have been in charge of the E section, the edit section. Which bits do you want to tempt us with today on Midori House?
Yeah, I have the best section, of course.
You do, actually. You have the fun bit.
I love it, yeah. It's all food and travel-related, a bit of design and accessories. This issue in particular, I like the bigger specials. We have our recipe page here.
I was about to say, this edition strikes me as being particularly delicious.
It is.
Because we have something, we're going to go to Milan in a moment and hear about a very beautiful recipe for tagliata alla Robespierre. But you wanted to take us to New York and show us the perfect recipe for a chicken, for a rotisserie chicken, which I argued was actually really hard to do.
Well, that's a thing. It looks hard, but it isn't hard. What's difficult is getting like the seasoning right. But Aisha made sure to interview the people of the Smile restaurant, and they guide us and the readers on how to make it. It's an easy 5-step recipe, and as you can see in the pictures, the outcome is just beautiful and delicious.
So this was Smile to Go's restaurant in New York that Aisha Spears went to. Great recipe for rotisserie chicken, if you were tempted to do that, and also a very good, and the most key important thing with rotisserie is what the accompaniments with. So the accompaniments are, I should say, and there's a very good recipe for slaw, ladies and gentlemen. But more importantly, we have a very beautiful article about Milan.
Yeah, so Ivan went to this restaurant called Santo Storgio and interviewed Lapo Elkan, who is the founder of the lifestyle brand Italian Dependent and one of the owners of the Fiat Emporium. And I actually talked to him a minute ago because I was jealous. If you look at the pictures, I really wanted to go to this restaurant, but he instead took Lapo. So I say we hear the interview.
Yes, that's right. Lapo got his invite in first, so I took him. the funny thing is, for his last meal, not now, you know, an Italian, you'd think that for their last meal they would choose a pasta dish. But funnily enough, Lapo decided to go with steak is his main course, and also a great pizza. Now, Santa Storgia is in a traditional part of Milan. It's next to a very old basilica. So I was actually surprised because I thought Lapo might take me to a more fashion-y place. But this was just a nice traditional trattoria.
And besides that, I see here a delicious pizza. I'm a fan of pizza. He ordered a type of prosciutto called prosciutto di Norcia. Can you tell us a bit more about this this type of ham?
Yeah, Norcia is is like Parma ham, so it's a cured pork meat. It's from Umbria, and it's produced in an area about 500 meters above sea level, so it's salted and air dried. Not as famous, let's say, as Parma ham and maybe some other prosciutto, but I found it to be quite tasty over this simple margherita pizza, and that was our appetizer to prepare us for the main course.
There's also another picture of Lapo leaving the restaurant in a very, very blue car. What car was this? Because Lapo used to be involved with Fiat very closely. Is he still driving Fiat?
Yeah, no, of course. I mean, his grandfather, everybody knows Gianni Anelli, you know, his role with Fiat, and Lapo is now with his brother and sister, you know, heir to this fortune. He showed up actually with two cars. One was a, of course, classic Ferrari, an FF, this four-seater, which I haven't, you know, seen many of them. And it's actually quite funny because as the meal was finishing, there were school kids coming out with the teacher, and they were all amazed when they saw this Ferrari sitting there next to a very old Romanesque basilica. And all the kids gathered around, and Lapo was nice enough to get up and show the kids both cars. The other car, which he actually drove, was a Cinquecento, which is the classic little...
Topolino.
Well, yeah, it was the big car during the economic boom in the 60s, and Fiat decided to reintroduce it, and Lapo was very involved in the marketing of that. And see, now they're actually trying to sell it also in the States.
And I noticed that Lapo didn't order any desserts, but he ordered an espresso, quite obviously. What is it with Italians and espresso at the end of meals?
Yeah, you'll never find an Italian, self-respecting Italian, go into a Starbucks, I think. They want their espresso a certain way, and no other country, no other company, I think, in the world will be able to offer a coffee to an Italian. So he was very actually adamant about this, talking about his morning espresso, and then, of course, you know, Italians usually have one after lunch. It's something where I don't think any coffee chain or any other thing. Italians, you know, like their coffee at the bar with their meal at the end of the day, and they're not into, you know, grande, ventis, half whites, and all that.
So you off to get your espresso now with Ivan?
Yeah, yeah. Do you want one?
Would you mind?
Single or double?
Double.
Cool.
Thank you very much indeed for joining us in the studio, Santiago Tarditi, our edits editor. It's 1:30 here on Midori House. Stay with us because in the next half hour we'll be having a special London mayoral debate. But before that, James Luckhurst has the latest world headlines.
A United Nations-backed court has convicted former Liberian President Charles Taylor of war crimes. It's the first time an African head of state has been found guilty by an international tribunal. Taylor was charged with 11 counts of murder, rape, conscripting child soldiers and sexual slavery during wars in Liberia and Sierra Leone, during which more than 50,000 people were killed. Syria has blamed what it calls terrorist bomb makers for an explosion that ripped through a building and killed 16 people in the city of Hama. The Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, a British-based anti-Assad organisation tracking the 13-month-old conflict, gave the same death toll but said the cause of the blast was not clear. Protests in Bahrain have attacked a police station with petrol bombs. Riot police responded with tear gas and stun grenades after a funeral march for a man who was killed in clashes during the Formula One race last week. France and Germany are looking to gather support among other European countries for new rules which will make it easier to suspend passport-free travel in Europe. The move comes as part of a bid to limit illegal migration. The number of jobless people in France rose for the 11th successive month in March to hit the highest level since September 1999. Commentators say the announcement will add a new dent in President Nicolas Sarkozy's economic record as he battles to get re-elected next month. The News Corp chief executive Rupert Murdoch said he had no regrets about closing down the News of the World newspaper during an inquiry in London. The appearance before a judge by the world's most powerful media mogul was a defining moment in a scandal that has laid bare collusion between ministers, police and Murdoch's News Corp. And at least six people have been killed in explosions at the offices of a leading Nigerian newspaper this day. Three people were killed in a blast in Abuja, with another three killed at the paper's offices in the northern city of Kaduna. Those are the main stories here at Monocle 24.
James, thank you very much indeed. And James Luckhurst will be back with a full roundup of the world news stories at the top of the hour. In a moment, we'll be chatting about the lives and election prospects of London's top mayoral candidates, Boris Johnson and Ken Livingstone. Taking us there, let's have a suitably London-themed song. This is The Kinks and Waterloo Sunset. The Kinks there and Waterloo Sunset on Monocle 24. It's 24 minutes to the top of the hour and we turn to the subject of the day, Ken and Boris, or Boris and Ken. Londoners have no need for last names when it comes to the two main contenders for the capital's biggest prize. It's 4 years since the two political mavericks fought for Londoners' votes, and during their last campaigns, Ken and Boris were summed up respectively as tragedy and comedy by their nearest rival, Brian Paddick. Well, a week from today, Ken Livingstone will vie to snatch the title back from Boris Johnson. So how will this year's battle play out between two men who seem so different but who possibly share similar traits of being political outsiders, desperate for power but perhaps also their own worst enemies? Well, for today's debate, joining me in the studio are Boris and Ken's biographers. Sonia Purnell's book, Just Boris, has been praised as meticulous and quietly devastating. It's also been condemned as total rubbish by Boris Johnson's father. And Andrew Hoskin is the author of Ken, The Ups and Downs of Ken Livingstone, an unauthorised biography that Arcadia apparently paid its largest advance for. I'm also joined by Tom Edwards, Monocle's new news editor. A warm welcome to the studio, all three of you. Let me start with you first, Sonia. What a attracted you to writing a biography of Boris Johnson?
Well, he's just a very, very different person from the normal politician. I've known him for 20 years. I used to work with him in Brussels. We both worked on the Telegraph together. And I realised back then, yeah, he was really, really not a normal journalist. There was something sort of special about him. He was far more ambitious, actually, than most of us. He had his eye always on the sort of the main stage in life. And so even back then, I thought, my goodness, you know, you're not going to be a journalist for very long. You're going to do something much bigger. And he went on to do that. In 2002, actually, I wrote a piece inviting readers, sort of saying, you know, imagine him as Prime Minister on the steps of Downing Street with his jacket pocket sort of floating in the wind and his tie with that morning's breakfast on it. And everyone thought this was an absurd idea, but actually everyone's talking about him now as a potential leader, so it wasn't that absurd.
He is, in many ways, people instantly see him as a career politician. He's always got his eye on the next prize.
Well, I think that's true. He once gave a mutual friend a piece of advice, which is every time you go for a job, only see it in terms of what it can give you for the next job. And I think he does see that. And I think he probably also sees his second term as mayor as a stepping stone onto even greater things. He is a very strategic person, that's true.
Andrew, you tell the tale in your book of a boy born off Streatham High Road, disappointment to his mother who wanted a girl, small and insecure, failing in his 11 plus exams. What do you think drove him to become the Ken Livingstone that we all see?
That's a very good question, because when you meet him and you spend hours talking to him, as I have, he doesn't strike you as somebody who is really ambitious, but he has been very ambitious. I mean, he sort of got into local politics, which is very boring. Most people don't want to do local politics. And he forged a career much more different path than Boris Johnson, had a much more gilded upbringing and many more opportunities. Ken Livingstone did not have any of those opportunities, and therefore he had to build a political career in the council chamber and through caucuses and making alliances with obscure little Trotskyist groups that no one's ever heard of, who probably could hold their annual general meetings in a telephone box. And he's you know, then he took over various positions on the GLC and when the Greater London Council. Of course, no one wanted to be a member of the Greater London Council. They couldn't think of anything more boring. But he was prepared to become a member of the Greater London Council. He worked his way up through there with his left-wing mates and then held a coup in 1981 to capture the leadership of the Greater London Council. And that act sort of propelled him overnight into the Ken Livingstone we all know today.
This was the man who suddenly found himself as the man that all who is the quintessential Londoner at that point, wasn't he? And that sort of sealed him as he sort of created the role of mayor almost for himself at that point.
Well, yes, he did. I mean, he's always from 1981, been associated very much with London and running London. But of course, when he seized the leadership of the Labour Group on the GLC in 1981, he was considered anathema to the Tory press and the government, who thought, well, what is this awful Trotskyist man doing running London? And almost from that moment onwards, and he then went on to say encouraging words about Sinn Féin and other very unpopular causes. And from that moment on, really, Mrs. Thatcher made it her, you know, life's ambition to close down the GLC and abolish it, and which he did in 1986. So it was really as a result of Ken Livingstone and the way he ran the GLC and took it over that London was left bereft of a voice until 2000, when we got our mayor, who happened to be Ken Livingstone. You couldn't really make it up as a story.
Subsequently replaced by Boris Johnson in 2008. Andrew just mentioned the description of Ken Livingstone as an awful Trotskyist man. The Guardian has...
Not my words.
Not your words, but a national British newspaper, The Guardian, has described Boris in equally unflattering terms at the moment, a millionaire old Etonian who considers a £250,000 salary chicken feed and belongs to a party squeezing the poorest while cutting tax for the richest. Clearly, these are two characters which are neither considered to be potentially sympathetic. What is it, do you think, about Boris that got him to where he is?
Charm and drive. Actually, both men, I think, had pretty challenging childhoods, and maybe there's something in those early years that have given them that absolute determination to succeed. Boris definitely has it. He's immensely charming. He's got this sort of emotional intelligence that a lot of politicians don't have. I mean, certainly Gordon Brown didn't have it, where he's able to make whichever particular group or person he's talking to at a time feel brilliant, and as if he understands their problems and empathises with them. He will then move on very quickly, but for those few seconds or few minutes, they're made to feel really good. And when he makes a speech or when he writes a column, he often uses the word friends or amigos or mes amis or, you know, whatever a variation of it. He sort of invites people in, sort of pretending this is kind of like an intimate relationship. It isn't. In fact, he's quite aloof and a very sort of secretive and sort of quite a loner of a man in a way. But you feel like you're part of Boris's world and that you therefore have some kind of ownership over him, and therefore you forgive his gaffes and you laugh at his jokes and you don't mind the fact that his suit is scruffy and his, you know, his hair's been deliberately sort of fluffed up into a mess. And so he's one of us, or people feel. I mean, he's not, but that's the effect that he creates.
He does, actually. On a couple of occasions that I've had the opportunity to meet Mr. Johnson, the two things I remember is that, one, that he stares you hard in the eye.
There you go,
and
yes.
It becomes a sort of eyeballing match to see who breaks first. And secondly, he always deliberately ruffles his hair just before the camera goes. So this is actually a very self-conscious ploy that he's coming across with the messy hair.
Well, indeed. In fact, in my book, there are quite a few pictures of him and how he looked when I met him, which he had very, very neat hair. I'd love to have hair as neat as that. But once he really started going for his ambition, he knew that he could not be seen to be too gritty, too ruthless, too thrusting. And so how he sort of diffused that was two things: A, ruffling his hair and wearing scruffy suits, but B, getting on his bike. So then he was man of the people, he was friendly, enlightened, he was out in the open air, very wholesome. And so he's the most brilliant PR genius, in my view.
I just wonder, though, you mentioned about him being one of us, even though he isn't really. I mean, to a cynical London public, how does his popularity, enduring popularity, with people who would traditionally be his sort of natural opponents, if you will, how do you explain that? Is it just because of this charm, or is there something else in his sort of idiosyncratic appeal that rings with people?
I think it's partly the wit. People like that. So I think if someone is funny and apparently quite self-deprecating, people think, well, he can't possibly be up to anything because, you know, he's so funny and witty, and I'd love to go to the pub with him, and what fun. And I think that feeling survives, even though we're all having quite a hard time of it at the moment. It's almost like he might cheer us up. I think that's actually really important.
Andrew, what would you say to that?
Well, Sonia and I have discussed this a couple of times, how similar the two men really are in a way. Ken also is a very good speaker. Ken also, you know, has made his name on Have I Got News For You. Ken also can warm up a room just by entering it, and he has that one-to-one appeal with people who once they met him are convinced that he loves them and wants to champion their causes. But again, Ken is also quite, in his own way, quite aloof. He's always been very, he's always operated with a very close-knit bunch of people around him. He's not terribly trustworthy of the press. For example, I mean, my book was the one that disclosed he had three other children that he had never sort of fessed up to, or never had sort of spoken at all about to anybody. And when I said to him, well, look, you know, this will have to go in the book, he said, well, it's a political biography. Why does it have to? And I said, well, because we don't want to go into their private lives or the rest of it. But I think people at least have the right to know how many children you have. Because at the time, that was quite surprising, because a lot of people thought he'd been in the papers, he'd been around in public life for 30 years. They knew all about him, and yet they didn't know something very, very significant about him, was that he actually was the father of five children.
You mentioned the fact that Ken Livingstone keeps people very close to him, and this was the great thing that everybody accused him of, which was cronyism from 1981 onwards. It is a criticism that has been levied both at Livingstone and at Boris Johnson.
Yeah. I mean, he's fiercely loyal to people, and I think, like Boris, hangs on to people longer than he should. When he was in trouble towards the start of the last election, particularly with newspapers campaigning against his mayoralty, there were certain people he really should have dropped pretty quickly. And he didn't. He hangs on to them. And he said to me, you know, I will never admit I'm wrong about anything. never admit you made mistakes, and never let go of people, particularly when the press are telling you to get rid of them. And I think probably Boris has a little bit of that, although he got through quite a few deputy mayors at the beginning.
Well, he did. But he doesn't have cronies. I mean, there is no Johnson clique, like there is a Livingston clique. And so, in fact, when
there are sympathies, though. There are people who he will whose ear he has, and one I think a lot of criticism that's been levied at him is that he is a fan of going for a dinner with some bankers at the end of the evening, and the criticism is that he is the banker's friend.
Yes, he's friendly with the bankers. I'm not sure that you would say that he's a friend. I mean, he doesn't actually socialise that much. He is quite a sort of, well, he's a very private individual. So, yes, of course he's friendly with the bankers. I mean, a lot of them have been his donors, but I wouldn't say that they were friends, and nor would I say that he has many friends in politics either. Some people might think that they're his friend, but they're not really. There is no clique, which is a strength in one way, because he does it all himself, he does it his way. But in another way, if he does want to become leader of the Conservative Party, he doesn't have that ready-made faction in the parliamentary party anyway. I mean, the party at large love him. I mean, everyone out there on the streets in the party absolutely love him. But in Parliament, that's not the case so much.
The last few minutes have been devoted to talking about the men and their overwhelming personality, which in many ways is what's driving and always has driven their campaigns and their identity as London Mayor. Let's move briefly on to what their achievements were while in office. Let's start with you, Andrew, because the role was just crafted by Ken, wasn't it?
It was, really. And also, the mayor has acquired more powers since 2000. But, you know, Ken brought in the congestion charge. Ken put more buses on the road. I mean, some of them were bendy buses and people don't like them very much. And he wasn't a great fan of the route master. It has to be said that Ken had obviously 8 years compared to Boris's four. And Ken was the mayor of London during a time of unprecedented public expenditure. I mean, you know, public spending from 2000 all the way through to 2007 really shot up. And Ken had the benefit of all this money that was being piled into the tube. So that was his achievement, mainly in transport, it has to be said, and also getting the Olympics. I think he played a big role in getting London the Olympics, for good or ill, depending on where you sit on the Olympics. But he also played a role in that. I mean, he was a figurehead at a time when London needed a figurehead to meet foreign dignitaries, the Olympic officials and all the rest of it, and he was that person, along with Tony Blair also, who played a big part in it.
I just wonder, though, I mean, sometimes there's been claims that it's been more political grandstanding. It's certainly in terms of transport policy, maybe for both men.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's a fair criticism. I think there are certain things, for example, housing, where the mayor is pretty powerless. I mean, they talk about, Boris does. You know, I'm putting 50,000 new houses in London this year, but a lot of it's through planning, and they can't build houses. I mean, and London is in housing need. A lot of young people cannot afford to live in even some of the roughest parts of town, and that's been a big failure, I think, of London government in the last 10 or 15 years. But in transport, yeah, I mean, you know, we're getting Crossrail built. There is money. You may not be able to spot it immediately going into the tube. You can certainly see it on some of the stations that are being renovated. So things have changed an awful lot, I think, and I think a lot of that is down to the fact that the capital has a mayor.
You're listening to Midori House. It's 10 minutes to the top of the hour. And we're joined by Sonia Parnell and Andrew Hoskin, biographers of Boris Johnson and Ken Livingstone, respectively. We'll be back with more after this.
It started with a shop in London's Marylebone, and now Monocle has stores in New York, Tokyo, Hong Kong, and a shop in Osaka. And then there's the Monocle Cafe in Tokyo. Come in to find exclusive collaborations with brands we believe in. From Barenna jackets to Porter luggage. Great for gifts, even better for personal treats. And if you're missing an issue from your Monocle archive, we can soon fix that. Visit monocle.com for store addresses and opening times. The Monocle Shop. Carefully crafted design, proud of its provenance.
Every Saturday on The Review, Monocle's editors ditch their jackets and unbutton their top buttons for a cosy weekend look at what's selling at bookshops from Buenos Aires to Brisbane.
This store was insanely busy. It was incredible. So if you had walked in on that day from outer space, you would never have had any clue that people weren't passionately in love with physical books.
A survey of the Global Newsstand, some fine tracks chosen by a great music guest, and lots of good conversation. Join us every Saturday at midday London time. And remember, this show is best enjoyed with coffee while camped out on your sofa.
Welcome back to Midori House. It's 8 minutes to the top of the hour, and we have a special mayoral debate to do with London. I'm joined by Sonia Parnell and Andrew Hoskin, biographers of Boris Johnson and Ken Livingstone. Sonia, just before we had the break there, Andrew was telling us all about the achievements that Ken Livingstone had, such as the Oyster Card, the congestion charge, the renovation of the tube, the securing of the Olympics. Boris is very keen about talking about Roman leaders and, you know, their achievements and their legacies. In 200-300 years' time, what's Boris's legacy going to be?
Well, that's a very good question, actually, and I think even he might be slightly hard pushed to answer it. The fact is, I think a lot of people who supported him very much in 2008 are quite disappointed with his mayoralty. He's a very talented person, who was, as we've already discussed, very clever. He came in on this sort of surge of popularity, but the actual achievement list is quite short. I think everyone would point to Boris Bikes, as they've become known, as the cycle hire scheme, which is great fun and quite popular, but is costing an awful lot of money, about 100 million over this mayoralty, which is a lot of money in sort of times of austerity. And a lot of sort of problems have got worse. I mean, Boris himself says that the tube performs much better than it used to. But I think if you talk to a lot of people on the Jubilee line or the Bakerloo line again today, they might be surprised by that claim. So it's been a surprisingly low-key mayoralty, to be honest.
Let's move on now to the idea, to the influence that London has on the global stage, and you know, Livingstone and Johnson's influence onto that project. We have the Olympics coming up, secured by Ken Livingstone, but delivered by Boris. Many argue that the Olympics is not necessarily an excuse to watch everybody excel at sport, but to see how a city actually operates under the stresses of an enormous event. How do you think Livingstone, Johnson have succeeded on this?
Well, I think the key thing for Ken Livingstone, doesn't like sport very much and isn't very sporty, and I don't think has ever excelled in any particular sport. His main thing was he described it as sort of having a housewarming party for a really good house, i.e., you know, what is going to be the legacy of the Olympics. That's the critical thing. It's going to be, you know, 3 or 4 marvellous weeks for people in London, people coming out from outside, but what is it going to leave behind? And that's been a big issue. And if you talk to some of the London Borough council leaders in that part of town, they're all very worried about it. So what will Ken leave behind? What will be the legacy? And I think that's the main thing, because, you know, you would imagine it might be something that will help kickstart the economy in London, which has suffered. But I think he'll be judged by that. And the Olympics will be fun, you know, for a while and very exciting. But what will they leave behind? That's the key question.
And how do you think Boris has managed to capitalise on that idea of legacy, which Andrew has said has prompted quite a lot of concern, that basically they're building a really big white elephant in the east of London that will be abandoned 2-3 years, and the education that everybody was promised isn't going to happen, and the regeneration is going to be temporary?
I think that if Boris does win next week, and I suspect he probably will, I think his second term is going to be quite hard for that reason and for lots of others. People will then start looking at, well, what has the Olympics done for East London and Stratford? And if they don't think very much, then they might actually blame Boris rather than Ken. I think also the money tap is going to be very firmly switched off by George Osborne, partly because he's going to be a rival, I dare say, for leadership of the Tory party at some point, but also because there is no money and London's done quite well until now. And that was partly because they wanted Boris to be re-elected. But if that happens next week, then they don't have that concern anymore. I think he's not, if he gets back, you know, as mayor of City Hall, he's not going to enjoy his second term. I think it's going to be really tough. And I think, therefore, leaving a legacy is going to be even tougher.
One of the things that he's talked about extensively is the Estuary Airport, which could be the great Boris legacy. However, it's going to cost an absolute fortune, and the infrastructure involved in it is going to cost a fortune as well. How realistic a prospect do you think this is, given the fact that London really does have to catch up on the global scale, on the global stage, in terms of being an international hub?
Well, I've noticed that in a couple of interviews recently in debates and things, that Boris has seemed to distance himself from that airport, the whole idea, which sort of indicates perhaps there's a sort of a cooling in Downing Street as well. What he has maintained the whole time is that he doesn't want to see a third runway at Heathrow, but then we don't seem to have another alternative. I mean, people talk about Gatwick, maybe that will be what happens, but there is no clear vision at the moment as to what we can do about our sort of air capacity, or rather lack of air capacity.
Tom, we were mentioning before we went on air the fact that the elections are coming up, and the fact that it is going to be personality driven again, isn't it? And it's failings that could actually just knock them out, each man out of the race.
Well, that's what I mean. I wondered, Andrew, whether you had a view that is it the decisive advantage to Boris perhaps could be because he sort of wins in the charm stakes, and if not, has anything that sort of tripped up Ken? Is it something, a character driven thing, or is it just circumstance, ill luck?
That's a very good question. I think Ken is not looking as assured and as professional as he did the last election and previous elections. I don't think he's got the right kind of people that he used to have around him. A couple of key figures have gone, and I think he's made a few boobs. I mean, the main one I can think of was when he was challenged about his tax affairs. He accused Boris of having a similar arrangement, which he didn't. I mean, we know as journalists that you don't go around, if you're gonna make an accusation stick, I mean, you have the facts, and that was very clumsy and made him look very. And then it was turned on him, and then he was asked about his earnings, and he declined to disclose all of his earnings, and that made him look shifty. So he kind of looked shifty, and I think that if you look, what's astonishing, I think, about Ken and Boris now is the turnaround in their popularity. If you look at, you know, Ken was always traditionally way ahead of his own party in terms of, I mean, if you look at when as an independent in 2000, you know, he walked it, despite the fact that Labour had their own candidate. And now Boris is ahead of his own party. And I think, and Ken is behind his own party. So it's going to be very, very interesting come polling day how that's all going to fit together.
I'm afraid we're going to have to leave that there. Sonia Purnell, author of Just Boris, and Andrew Hoskin, author of The Ups and Downs of Ken Livingstone. Thank you very much indeed. That's all for this Thursday's edition of Midori House. Thank you also to Tom, who's come in. Today's show was produced by Daniel Giacopelli and researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco. At 2200 hours London time, that's in 3 hours, join Ted Kravitz and Andrew Muller with the Monocle Daily. From all of us on Midori House, goodbye.